Okay. Thanks very much, Bob, and for the kind invitation. This is an interlude or a diversion from what theoretical physicists are paid to do. So bear with me, I'm an outsider. I've gotten involved in issues which are over my head. It started about 10 years ago when I got interested in issues of health, and in particular, HIV/AIDS. And that very quickly led me to issues like development, because I was working in partly in around New Mexico and with the Department of Health, and also in India with schools and rural communities. So you quickly understood that health could not be solved in isolation. Development is essential. So what I'll try and do today is give a talk in two parts. One is what motivated me to think about the issues and the energy system as it exists today. And it'll be very, very high level with very little detail, and I can answer questions. And then the second half I like to spend on describing a web-based tool which I'm building with some students at the University of New Mexico to try and understand this global energy system. So my attention to energy as a crucial ingredient for development starts about 4 years back, and it was related to the fact that when I was working with rural communities in India, it became clear that without energy, it was unlikely they would develop. So he said, oh great, that's easy, we have plenty of energy, let's go figure out how to get these poor guys some more energy. You come back, you realize, oops, there's a big problem. Energy is going to be a challenge not just for the poor in marginalized villages, it's a global issue. So that is the starting point. So here, I just want to emphasize again an example of what many of you have heard about is the rise in the carbon dioxide levels. And the only thing I'm going to focus on here is that in the last 7-8 years, we see a deviation from a historical record which people thought was a linear rise. And that has some people concerned, have we already passed the linear stage? So the phenomenon I'm going to leave you with is that climate change and the whole greenhouse effect is a highly nonlinear phenomenon. And most of you know that there is a certain threshold beyond which resources which we have available to us will not be sufficient to deal with such a nonlinear phenomenon. And we should act in time before that situation is reached. So starting, I mean, I just want to very quickly acknowledge some of the students whom I work with at University of New Mexico in building the project. And it's been fun, and we've been working at this for about 9 months. And I've had some colleagues who've come in and out of the project in Los Alamos. So starting with development, this is a slide I like to show of my cartoon of the world as it exists today. There are about 2 billion people who live in the 21st century. By 21st century, I mean like us who have access to healthcare, education, job skills. We have access to energy at our fingertips and potable water in our bathrooms. So this is the world of about 2 billion people. About half of that is in the developed world, and the other half is about the 15% of the top strata in the rest of the world. 3 billion people worldwide live on less than $2 a day. So if you close your eyes and ask yourself, what could you buy for $2 a day? You would realize that it's basically survival. Clothes are hand-me-downs. Everything you would have to think about, you would realize that you have no discretionary income other than just basic survival. So there's no way families or people could invest anything into healthcare, into education for their kids of any substance. So, and this we have recognized, we realize people who are, who've in our country fallen through the cracks, we have to provide them with education, healthcare, and job skills because their families cannot provide them. There's about 1.5 billion people in transition, or today it's actually 1.65 billion people. We are adding about 70 million people a year to the population. So the tragedy is, and this is one thing, again, I would like to emphasize before physicists, and I mean, it's a parenthetical remark, but the entire growth of population pretty much is happening in this lowest quintile of the population. So we have a double problem that not only do we have to raise the 3 billion people who are already in this mess, but almost the entire population growth, of which it's almost impossible to think about not adding the next 2.5. I mean, you would have to have a amazingly draconian something happen for the next 2.5 billion not to be added, because there's just the inertia of the population bulge will carry you through. So we have to some point understand that if you are going to deal with these issues of resources, not just energy, but water, anything, we have to address the issue of reproductive health, of stabilizing the population, of women's rights and stuff. So physicists, please do think about that and add your voice to that picture. So this is really overall thing. So if you want to help provide this energy to this 6.6 billion today or 9 billion people tomorrow, what historically has happened over the 20th century was energy was extremely cheap. I mean, when you think about the cost of energy in stuff you buy, it was almost negligible. I mean, it was so dirt cheap, we didn't care. We burnt it, we used it, it was plentiful, it was cheap. The new thing which started getting put onto this landscape was clean. It started in the 60s and 70s with Rachel Carson and her work, or the whole acid rain issues. So we started cleaning out stuff which we could actually see tangible effects of, acid rain. But today it's become much more severe, and we are talking about not just things which are health hazards in the sense of direct impacts, but greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, which is completely benign other than its greenhouse effect. Right. 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 Well, if you look in constant dollars, I have the things I can show you later. In constant dollars, it's almost flat. No, I said it's been cheap throughout. I didn't say it's become cheaper. It's just been incredibly cheap all through the 20th century. For the developed world. Yes, it's still cheap. For the developed world. So one of the things which is amazing, which has come out of the IPCC report, and I think the most significant to my mind, is that the 2007 report A says unequivocally, look, we have a problem, and now there are even debates of whether they should have the next iteration of it, because they said, what more can we do? But the other thing which I think is very significant is they've stopped pointing fingers. They said, look, this is a global problem. We need to solve it as a cohesive, integrated community and not say, oh, it's China's fault or US fault or India's fault. It's us together, and we're going to live or die as a community. So I think both the needs, if you're going to solve this problem, we have to address the needs. A person will burn wood if they have nothing else to cook their food with. And the impacts are also global. So we have to treat this as solving both problems. So I'm going to very quickly now try and say, okay, so how do we think about this problem? So there are two sectors. There's electric power generation and there's transportation. Over the last 50 years, most of the power which we have is provided by coal, thermal power, natural gas, uranium, nuclear power, and hydropower. Each of these four have with them issues which make us think about that this is not the perfect ideal solution. Coal had a lot of pollution, acid rain, and in addition to mercury and now carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gases. We've started cleaning up the others, but not mercury, not greenhouse gases. Natural gas, again, greenhouse gases. Nuclear power is waste. And the hydropower, there are extreme issues of ecology, especially for large dams. And some of the dams which were built in the early part of the 20th century, we already see have now are serious ecological issues associated with them. So if we want to move forward, we have to basically address the ecology issue, and we have to remove the greenhouse gas emissions. and address the waste issue with nuclear power. The two alternate... No, I wasn't intending to. That's the proliferation issue of nuclear power and waste management. So that's what I mean, that this whole thing, by this waste, I mean you have to solve the proliferation problem, you have to solve the storage problem, and you got to solve the safeguards. So I'm not going to say anything more. I mean, that's a whole talk in itself. So I'm just saying we have to address these. In transportation today, every single form produces greenhouse gases. The traditional oil is from conventional oil through a conventional refinery. And if we call this as one unit of CO2, then coal to liquids is about 2 to 2.5 times. So if we have plenty of coal, we can convert it into liquid fuel because carbon is fungible. But the cost in terms of environment is pretty high. It takes about 2.5 tons of coal to produce a ton of oil. Tar sands, similarly, about 2 to 2.5 times the pollution. Again, if you would like, go on to Google Earth to some of the Athabasca tar pits, and you will see a huge mountain of yellow, that sulfur which has been extracted from the tar sands. Again, a much more complex refinery, similarly from shale oil, a much more complex refinery. So unless we can do some of this stuff in situ, but even there we don't understand the full impacts at the gigaton scale, these have much higher carbon footprints than conventional coal. Today, biofuels are still about as carbon intensive as oil from conventional. Again, the hope is that somehow we can bring it down. So that's where we stand with respect to the two major sectors, which is transportation and electric power. So the first thing, which is all of us would like the system to change, but it's not going to change in any short period of time. Because think about it. I mean, I just did a back of the envelope calculation, and you realize the world has invested at least $25 trillion in this existing system. Yes. Yes. Yeah. 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 So it's a total carbon footprint for growing the corn, for transporting it, and then for processing it. Again, these are ballpark figures because there are raging research papers being written, whether it's 0.8, 0.1, 0.1.1. To first approximation, it's still in that thing. The one place where it is less is, of course, sugarcane in Brazil. But that's, there are certain pockets always where you can have a much more effective industry. But by and large, so if you just do a back of the envelope calculation, you find that it's something of, I don't know, some people say 25, some people say 35. Depends how you count it, how you amortize the stuff. But it's huge. And you can see it's an absolutely stunning infrastructure we've put into place. And it provides modern energy and mobility to about 3.5 billion people. So now the question is, so you want to move the world away from that. What are our alternatives? So if you look at it with a population of about 10 billion people, which, as I told you, I mean, which is almost inevitable by 2025, we'll have 8.5, 9 billion people. We're adding 70 million a year. You will need about 10 terawatts of electric power. So that's about a kilowatt per person. And that's around a third to a quarter of what we use today in the US. Every US citizen or US person in the US uses somewhere 3 to 4 in terms of electric. And in terms of primary power, it's about 12 to 13 kilowatts. What are our alternatives? Today, nuclear power has about 430 reactors producing about 370, or having a power of 370 gigawatts. Hydro is about 400 gigawatts. And given that most rivers have been tapped, and stuff, the total potential we foresee is about 600 gigawatts. This is highly variable because if there's anything like global warming, the shifts in climate and in monsoons and everything will create a totally different picture of the sustainability of hydropower. Wind and solar have been growing very rapidly, so there is a huge potential, but it's very small. If you take the total installed at 2007 end, about 90 gigawatts peak, you divide this number by three to five, so even if you say 30 gigawatts, because wind doesn't always blow, to compare to the baseline loads of nuclear, hydro, and coal, you get about 30. You're seeing that even wind, which is the best resource today, is about 10% of the other renewables which have been there historically. Solar, this is peak. This is the total amount of installed peak. The average sustained used is about a factor of a third less or a fifth less, depending on where you are. No, I divide this by three, I get 30, so that's about 10% of each of those. Yeah. Geothermal, which again, today, most people have not sort of fully appreciated that heat pumps are very efficient ways of heating and cooling your homes. They, again, their deployment is very small. Most people are thinking in terms of large geothermal things, but just the heat pumps where you can use both for air conditioning and heating could become a major growth area, and I hope to see more of that. Biofuels, I don't know where it's going to go, and we'll talk just a tiny bit. My concern here is food versus fuel. Most countries I'm seeing that the cost today of fuel has become so high that many farmers are converting rich prime agricultural land into biofuel, biomass for biofuels. That's not sustainable. Then we need a huge study if we want to understand how to use marginal lands. What's the way out? What's the technological solution to get out of this situation? First and foremost, it's absolutely clear that there are about six or seven, whether you count fusion or not, challenges. My belief is not going to be one or the other. We will have to do all six because the scale of the problem is so enormous that not as one. There are possibilities that you could do it. If you could do this one at an incredible cheap rate, yes, it could solve everything. My guess is in the end, the answer will be a combination of all six. If you want to use coal or natural gas, then somehow we have to make it carbon neutral. Now here, what's the challenge? The three countries which have growing coal-fired power plant installations are China, India, and U.S. because of growing populations. U.S. has a fairly good sequestration possibility, geological sequestration. India doesn't, to first approximation, have anything. It's basically metamorphic rock. There are very few Permian Basin or deep saline aquifers. The cost of this is going to be enormous. China also has very little geological storage at the scale at which the need is. We'll have to come up with really innovative ways of figuring out how to make the use of fossil fuels carbon neutral. Next is making solar and wind economical. If we can bring the cost down to about $1 a watt peak for home-installed systems or even in the case of solar PV, that would be great. Concentrated solar power, which is a way of using mirrors to harness solar and then put a thermal plant, is close. It's about two, two and a half. Again, that industry is just beginning to take off. We don't have enough experience for people to invest. If solar and wind is going to become a large part of the mix, then storage and transmission become huge to overcome the intermittency of solar and wind. Again, concentrated solar power where you heat up some oil, that can be used as in a reservoir, which can extend the life of a thermal plant by about 5 to 6 hours in the evening, or depending on how big a storage. That's the only practical solution we have in terms of large-scale implementation of storage. But again, if we could have a factor of, say, even 5 breakthrough in battery technology, we would have a major change, firstly in plug-in hybrids, and then distributed storage available to the grid in to address that issue. So again, a huge issue here. Closed nuclear fuel cycle, this is all I'm going to address, and say that we need to really work on a global scale to provide safe and secure nuclear energy. This is an area which is very, very exciting. This is basically splitting water to get hydrogen, or that hydrogen can be boosted up to fuel. We just do one of the many processes for boosting it up, adding carbon and hydrogen chains. And that has to happen either through photochemical, which is just using mimicking nature in the and splitting water through photons, or thermal splitting if we can run nuclear power at high enough temperatures. But then you have to solve this problem before you can get enough thermal capacity. Biofuels, if you're going to use them on marginal lands, and if you don't want the huge amount of already the issues which we have with our agriculture, we have to design pest-resistant, self-fertilizing, low-water-using, easily degradable biomass. That's a huge challenge. So let me take you back to a workshop where Walter was also there about 2 years ago at Aspen, which was run by the Aspen Center for Physics. And we had about 50 physicists who heard all this and got very excited. And as any physicist, oh, we have to solve this problem. Let's go do it. So Shelley was there at this meeting also. We had about 3 lunches together, and we kept hammering at it. So what does a physicist do? This is a geology problem. This has got to do with our chemistry. This is, again, a mechanical, and here it's a material science problem, the photovoltaics and stuff. Again, huge materials, chemistry problem. This is, again, a large part is chemistry, separation of spent fuel and stuff. This is, again, chemistry. There are about 3 or 4 Nobel Prizes in this process. This is, again, biology and chemistry. So what on earth does a physicist do? They're screwed. So at the end of 3 days, we realized, well, one thing a physicist could do was use their analytical skills to become for education and as a way of understanding what's fact from fiction. So that's the background. So part of the next part of the talk is in response to that. So this whole challenge has been cast in many different ways. So I just call it the 9 faces of the challenge. So what's very clear is that in US, Europe, Japan, China, India, they lack energy security. These are the major nations. None of them have enough energy of their own. They have to import energy, and that means that they lack energy security, especially in terms of conventional oil and gas. Even if we had all possible amounts of oil and gas, we still haven't solved this climate problem. If we burn too much to give people a cheap way of developing, we are in this trouble. If we don't, again, economy collapses. But that, fortunately, has been taken care of us by our wonderful bankers, so we don't have to worry. So maybe we'll fix it all because we won't have an economy. But then it's very clear. I mean, there's nothing missing. There's nothing hidden. Middle East and Russia control conventional oil and gas. If you look at it today, they are about 70% of the traded resource, and it's going to keep increasing. It's not going to decrease, that fraction. Increasing competition from China, just let me give you an example. China first starts importing oil in 1994. Today it's importing about 4 million barrels of oil a day. The thing which, I mean, everybody talks about increasing competition, but if you look at the difference between what America imported in 1994 and what it imported in 2004, our imports went up by 5 million barrels a day. So we never talk about the fact that we couldn't care, we were just happy burning oil. So this whole picture is an increasing competition, and the beauty of the 20th century was, basically, it served about 1 billion people. The developed world pretty much used up 90% of the modern energy. But that's changed, so we have to live with that. Today we accept that military solutions are too expensive. I mean, we cannot go fight wars in Middle East to get, or Russia to get oil and gas. In those days of, say, what's oil doing under Saudi sands are gone, I think. But again, in going through this whole thing, what was remarkable was that from 1945 to about 1998, the American policies, in hindsight, were just phenomenal. They gave us 50 years of the most enormous growth in our standards of living at almost no cost. I mean, if you think about it, it was basically zero cost. But that changed around 1998 with all the terrorism and the USS Cole and Tanzania bombings. And today we know that we are not going to go back to that nice, wonderful situation we had prior to 1998. It would take a miracle. So military solutions are too expensive. So how do we go around doing it? So one is the technology I mentioned. The second is this whole issue of energy efficiency and behavior change, which has been very hard to convince everybody. But will this system change? And here this was, again, a very remarkable thing. As physicists, we all dream of living in a time when things are happening, right? We all, I mean, my generation says, what was I doing from 1970 to 74 when there was the whole revolution and the Standard Model was created? Well, I was sleeping. You don't want to miss that opportunity, right? And especially sitting at KIDP in the middle of the string revolution, so you don't want to miss it. So are we in a period of time which is similar in the case of energy, or are we just at the wrong period of time? Because time and history make an enormous difference on whether something gets done. And the amazing thing is, yes, we are. We are in an absolutely remarkable time, because even though I told you this is an enormous infrastructure and it will not change overnight, yet the beauty is we are in the middle of that change. For two exceptional reasons, and those are that in industrialized nations, the entire energy system, the first generation energy system, was put into place, like in the US, in the 50s and 60s. It's run its course. Most of these plants will have to be rebuilt, or new plants will have to be put in. This is the perfect time. When somebody like McCain said they will build 30 nuclear reactors by 2030, nobody bothered to explain that by starting 2020, even if we do the best of circumstances, we are going to be in a negative decline with respect to nuclear power. More reactors will be retiring than we can bring online, even if we went ahead with an aggressive policy. Because the youngest reactor in 2030 will be 39 years old. The last nuclear reactor was turned on in 1991 in this country. So this is a phenomenal period in time. Similarly, in developing countries, for the first time, this infrastructure is being put into place. China is putting in 50 gigawatts of coal-fired power plants per year, and it's just gone berserk. India is starting in that same foot. This is the time. If we don't do anything for the next 20 years, we will have then frozen these systems for the next 50 years. So this is the time. But we need to change something. So another example is, and this comes back to my pet peeve of, again, population. The countries which are really very well placed to lead this, in some sense, are Europe and Japan. Because they have absolutely no population growth, actually declining populations. So they have a relatively simpler problem of replacement rather than growth. The US, I don't know how many of you know, has 160 coal-fired power plants on their drawing boards to be put into place in the next 10 years. Because our population is growing at 1%. That's 3 million people being added every year. So somebody has to provide them with power. We can't put in nuclear. Solar and wind aren't big enough right now. So in the end, what are you doing? Back to coal. Yes. Yeah, it's a policy decision. It's not scientific. Right. So, being an Australian, I've had a very interesting discussion. India is going to start importing a fair amount of Australian and South African coal. So the question came up once I was giving a talk, whom should the carbon be attributed to? So I said, obviously, half and half. And that, of course, got everybody very mad, because the people who are selling the coal, they don't want any part of that problem. They said, we sold it. Now it's their problem. The people saying, buying, oh, you're giving them all the money and no response. Yes. Right. Yeah, your Olympic mine is the biggest producer of uranium. Anyway, so nuclear power, so the second thing is, so population allows these countries, Europe and Japan, to actually make, to be the front runners. We have to work a little bit harder to get there. The other thing, both in Europe and Japan, is public transportation are part of the psyche. So transportation and in is used. So for example, when I was in India and I gave this a similar talk, they asked me, so what should we do? I said, look, India is going to urbanize at a phenomenal rate over the next 30 years. Incentivize public transportation as, I mean, the global system should say, here are your carbon credits. Put in public transportation system before you urbanize. I think transportation is about 40% of the thing. I mean, we know, we can do a simple calculation. It's 85 million barrels, which translates to about 9 billion. So in the US, transport is 2/3 of the oil consumed. I mean, it's not just, yeah, this is both, I mean, most of it is people transport. Yeah. I mean, as I said, there's no one single solution. What these are big solutions, which are part of the full solution. So, given this, what over the next 20, 30 years, we will have to have a combination of top-down, which is how do we generate our power, and how do we use it. And this is the final point at which I'm going to switch and go to, okay, I've given you this pessimistic story, I've given you how big the challenge is, so what did you do, which is what a typical physicist always asks, so what did you do in the end? So going back to the thing, so the stuff which I got fascinated by was the whole issue of education and really understanding the system. How do you make it possible for people to get their hands around this whole challenge, and not just the challenge of what's happening in your neighborhood, but what's happening globally, so you get a thing. So what I decided to do was create an open Wikipedia-like resource for mapping the world's energy system. So this is the part which I built with the students at UNM. And it consists of three databases. Oops, now it's going to be, hopefully, which are in the large infrastructure, so things like power plants, resources, gas, oil fields, uranium mines, and then transportation or transmission, which are pipelines, ports, roads, and railway lines, shipping, and electric power grid. So to actually map the world and see what the geospatial location is, how does it sit? So what I like to do is, and so this is like a Wikipedia, except it's moderated. So what I like to do is describe what we are doing, why we are doing it, and anybody can participate in it, and I'll show you how it works. So first thing is, when somebody wants to, say, for example, think about power plants, most of us don't have, I'm just going to log in so that I can do certain things. Anybody can log in, we don't track, it's just to make sure that we don't have people who are maliciously sort of destroying the system. So the first thing is, suppose, let's just pick a country like, say, Mexico, for which I have put in some data, and I want to understand that how, what's their distribution of gas-fired power plants. So the first tool is that basically just what we'll do is give you an overall feel for where those plants are, and then go back and try and understand what's the more detailed structure of this distribution. So shown here is the current set of, this is not an complete set, this is just what I've done so far, of the various gas-fired power plants which are installed in Mexico. So Mexico, what they have been doing is, for the first 30 or 40 years of their power generation, were dependent on fuel oil, which is essentially heavy oil, and now they're moving to natural gas. Heavy oil simply because they had oil resources. So the thing you can do is, you can go, this is an API to Google Maps. You can go in to the hybrid mode, and you can look at them. Each one of them is geospatially located. So it gives you a feel for where they are. If I can. So this, working on this project, you begin to really understand the computing power behind Google. So I could have actually simultaneously asked for coal, gas, nuclear, so as to get a relative framework, but I'm not doing it because you can see even one is slow. Come on, this is much slower than. So now, if you were interested in a given plant, you could click on it, it tells you what the plant is, what's the design capacity, and so that's just showing you where it is. But now what we want to do is create a database which can be used for scientific analysis. So this is a form-based system where anybody can go in and edit, just like Wikipedia, except that we have it highly structured. So it's not free format data, but it's data which is entered in a given format which you can then harness and you can analyze. So it has a number of features. So first, as I showed you, that there is we have it to an API to Google Maps. But what we've done is to start understanding the footprint. So what you see here is marked on the map, it'll come up, is actually the power plant. You can recognize that. And after a while, you get good enough, you can distinguish coal-fired from gas-fired from others. Here is the overall footprint. I haven't included this cooling water pond, but you can see what the square area is. And you can zoom in further, you can see the impact, and it's relatively clean. But so using these wonderful tools, which have now emerged in the last few years, you can actually start to layer impacts at different levels. So this is what I'm calling a direct impact, because this is a physical infrastructure. So had it been a coal plant, that would be much larger. So you can see that for a half a gigawatt plant, you have a footprint of about somewhere on the order of a quarter of a square kilometer. If you went to a gigawatt plant, you would still see it of the order of 0.3, 0.4 of a square kilometer. You go to a similar size coal-fired plant, just the plant itself, not all the stuff, it's already 2 to 3 square kilometers. So you can start to see, if you wanted to think in terms of real estate prices, there's a huge economic sort of difference there. The next thing is, we are working to try and see, and is incorporated in this, what's the next level of indirect impact through plumes, through the dispersal of plumes. So you can now start to see, if this was a coal plant, what's the area over which mercury is dissipated, or over which SOXes and NOXes, which give rise to acid rain, are dissipated. So then you have the second layer of impact, and you can start mapping that. Similarly, as you know, there are 1,300 or so dams in the US which are holding this sludge from coal-fired power plants. Only one burst, but all 1,300 of them were built 40 years ago to hold like one-third to one-fourth the amount of stuff which is already there. So those impacts we can start to quantify. Then it basically just capture as much information as you can. When was it installed? Who's the manufacturer? What kind of technology was used? And then track whether or not each of these units have control devices for removing the common greenhouse and pollutants, NOxes, N2O, SOx, mercury, and CO2, and whether you have monitoring devices. Because this tells you that it's not a back of the envelope calculation they are doing to tell you how much is being emitted. They actually have some monitoring going on. So you start to build a whole database. Here, for example, we're looking at, I've just got data of how much power was produced and how much are the emissions. And you can go in and edit any number here. So you can put in your number, the form accepts it, but now how do I keep it as a moderation process? So the idea of moderation is, after we had done it, we realized what we had done was actually to philosophically duplicated our peer review system. So basically, every contributor who comes in and contributes, you can think of them as writing a paper, submitting it to the journal. You submit it to the journal, what happens? The editor figures out who the appropriate referee is. So in this case, what we've done is you have contributors, you have editors, and you have moderators. If you submit something, it doesn't get immediately into the database. It's actually put into a stack, which we call the history of edits for that power plant. So here, for example, is a global history of edits of all the power plants, which is huge right now because I'm working with two university classes, and the TAs have been lazy in figuring out what to assign as the grade. So I'm waiting for that. But it comes into the stack, and then because I logged in as me and I have privileges, you can see that whether to accept these changes or not. So what I typically do I go in, I look at what they've submitted, and this anybody can see. So you get instant gratification that your entry is accepted, and then I can look at, see what these people added. And now, having seen this, I have two choices, or three choices. Say it's all garbage, so I reject it, which is what usually we get a reply from PRL. Or parts of it are correct, which says, we are ready to accept the paper provided you do these things. Or you say, it's all correct, and we accept. So here, what I would do is, I would take the pieces which are correct and provide another submission which then can be accepted. So I'll only pick out the pieces which are good, because we don't have this back and forth between the contributor and the editor. It's a one-time thing, so the editor just picks out what they think is useful. We'll come to a very interesting question. One step at a time. So this is the moderation process. So, and then what we have also done is built into it so that the moderator is rating the editors are rating the contributors. So there's a numerical score which is being pulled together, which actually, if you think about it, is how the peer review system works. It's never done as formally, but the editors, in the back of their mind, have a certain rating system for all the people they use as referees. They've just never formalized it into a numerical metric. But when a paper comes, they actually use that historical information to send it to the right referee. And the referee similarly then rates the paper which you submitted. So we've tried to digitize it for two reasons. Because obviously this process has to become automated, otherwise everybody will go crazy. So it's a way of implementing that. And it was interesting that what we did without actually realizing it and just being forced into thinking was recreate the peer review system. The other thing we've done with every single power plant, because not everybody is interested in contributing data in this scientific format, is to attach a discussion forum with each power plant where you can have free format information added. So at the moment it will get stored, but hopefully we can devise ways of how do you actually harness that information. Can you extract useful nuggets from that information or not? So this is attached to every single power plant for as just a discussion forum where you can put in pictures, you can put in downloads from or newspaper articles or what would you like. And again, very interesting challenge. So the first thing we said, oh, what if somebody now hijacks this site and starts using it for pornographic material? So very interesting challenges which you come across when you try and do something like this. Okay, so I explained that. So you can now view the data, you can add new power plants. So there's a whole format. I told you about the history of edits. And we, at this point in time, if you wanted to download the data, we have just one format, which is KML. And that's the format which you can use on Google Earth, because that's a sexy way to visualize it in 3D. So you can look at all this information. So the last part which I want to touch on before sort of this is the large infrastructure. This is power plants. I mean, I can show you all the uranium mines in Australia. I can show you the few solar installations in Kings Canyon and stuff. It's all, I mean, the amazing thing is, even with today's resolution on Google Earth, you can see them all. You can understand their footprint and you can follow them. So the last part is, okay, this is the part from the top down which I described. What's happening and how do you capture from the bottom up? So here we've created this survey because there are no established databases for individuals' use. So now coming to the point of, sorry, I didn't want to forget your question about many countries will not want to provide. So I was in India and I managed to, I think, irritate one person because he kept nagging me. He says, but what if we don't want to give the data? And I kept saying, see, one of the things about this thing is to come to a policy of what you want to give and what you don't want to give. I'm telling you very clearly, I will not put anything which is not public domain. You have to come up with a national policy of what you want to release or not. And so in the end, it was not a fun thing. But the basic point is that many of the countries have information available in public domain, but it's scattered all over. Today, if I asked you, you would not be able to go find it. I mean, most of Europe has now called something called a European Pollution Emissions Inventory. And it's in a format which you can't, it's each year is separated off, it's a different file here. So what this does is does a cohesive collation and collection of it. The second thing we are hoping is that if there are ever going to be environmental treaties, that will require a certain amount of transparency. You cannot have, I mean, that's one of the excuses the US government has given of not following Kyoto is because it was not enforceable. Because there was no monitoring, there was no way or no real structure of how do you implement it. So if you're going to implement this, yes. Oh yeah, there are examples. So China, yeah. Right. Oh yeah. Right. So. Right. So the thing is that, I mean, as you know very well, that if suppose there's a nuclear plant or a coal plant, say in the Rhine, West Ham, near Cologne or something wonderful, if you know how much power they are producing, And you know that sitting right next to that is the coal mine of bituminous coal or your brown coal in Germany. To very good approximation, you can figure out what the emissions are going to be. Because if they don't disclose the kind of scrubbers and all, you can figure it out. So once there is this very complete database, and you understand whether they are using Siemens technology or GE or stuff, you start to get within 10% very accurate understanding of what those emissions are. Then they have to say, look, my emissions are less because I've put in this kind of technology. So at some level, by having a standardized ontology and database, you basically start closing up the loopholes by which they can just sort of hide. Because it's not, I mean, if you're burning coal, you're burning coal. So unless you tell me you're doing this to remove SOXes or NOXes, those are going into the air. So that hiding part decreases. So let me show the last part, which is trying to capture the end use by people. So this is based on a survey, and this has to be volunteered information. So the other one where we are capturing both official databases and asking people to tell us, here we have no choice but to really get this volunteered information. So people are putting in, they are becoming like agents of change. So initially just select the metric system, even though it's not what we love. So if you just put in something like, so here is the first thing, I put in my the amount of electricity I use. I say 30% of my electricity is carbon neutral because 20% comes from a nuclear plant in Arizona and stuff. So it gives you that how much electricity I've used and what's the CO2 footprint. So here I'm not even going into the micro details, which many of these calculators have, how many compact fluorescents are you using. I'm just saying I'm going to track in time what your total consumption is. And if you have demonstrated for me that you're going to reduce your total consumption, then you're making the right choices. I am not going to be able to micro-tune you and say, have you exchanged your bulbs or you haven't. So this calculates the footprint, and then we can show it as a graph of what your footprint is, and then we'll have a little thing that so many, if you have like 11 tons, it will take so much of forest, or you would have to buy an acre of forest a year in order to offset that footprint. So it just gives a simple understanding of your footprint. You can similarly, we ask questions of whether you've installed solar panels, what are the makes. So again, this is informing your neighbor, informing, so you're learning the horizontal learning, you're providing yourself as an example, teaching others what works, what are your experiences, how much energy was generated, how much was saved. So we go through, and then for reducing footprint, we give you ideas of how you can do it. Change your appliances to Energy Star ratings, switch compact to filament to compact, and we can, each one of them has a help button. We can tell you why, how much do you save, do you bicycle to work, do you support, or do you, I mean, what temperature you set your house at or your thermostat at. So basically, it's very simple calculations, enough that people understand how you can do it and what the impact is. And each time you do it, that information is saved. It's geospatially recorded because we have, again, you can just put in your address and we have you down to wherever you are. You can mark where you are, where your house or your building is. So we can follow that in time. So this, at the moment, so this is the two ways of looking at top down and bottom up. And so the last months have been fun, 9 months have been fun in creating this infrastructure. So we are almost there. Another couple of months, we should have all these pieces working. This is not sexy. This is not like Facebook. And I mean, that, I take my hats off to those guys. I mean, they've raised the bar so high that somebody who's more interested in science cannot compete with them. So we are not trying to compete with them on that. But at least it's exciting in the sense that we have this framework. And now the question is, will enough people be interested in becoming partners in actually building it using it. So the place I'll end is, I've had a phenomenal collaboration with two, as I told you, educational institutions, which were both teaching a course in energy and environment. And they use this as a way of showing their students what's happening in the real world. So there were, like Carnegie Mellon had 12 students who chose 7 different parts of the world. And they actually went in to try and build this system, find out where the coal plants are and stuff. And for them, it was a phenomenal experience that in the class they learned about heat, Carnot cycle and stuff. And over there, they actually saw how the world was putting this information or this energy systems together. They wrote, sent emails to the power companies to get information, and that was a learning experience, that how few of them were willing to tell anything. But that's how I think we could have a phenomenal education system. So coming back to that summer workshop at Aspen and the remarks that what physicists can do is help educate. One of the things, because as I told you, the real discoveries are in the hands of chemists and material sciences scientists. So here is a tool which can be incorporated into the curriculum. So if somebody is interested or is teaching a course in energy and environment, love to work with them, figure out how we can make the tool better for them and also how they can use it as part of the projects or educational part for the course. So let me stop there. Thanks a lot. Yeah. I didn't say intractable. Sorry, don't get me wrong. I said today we are about 6.6 or 6.7 billion people. What I said was, dreamer that I am, I'm also a realist. The population bulge and the current practices, there's almost nothing we can do short of a draconian solution of no more kids, period. That will change the fact that we are going to go up to 8.5-9 billion people. Even if people had 2 kids today per family, you would still rise because of the population, the historical population bulge, the number of people of reproductive age. In that sense, I was saying it's... Yes, but I said that it has to, and physicists shouldn't ignore that this should be an agenda right on top of everything else, that reproductive health, and by that I mean not just having fewer kids, just the whole concept of reproductive health, stabilization of population, which is then of course coupled with women's rights, has to be the top agenda because it has an impact on everything. And fortunately, thank God, our new president has removed the gag order. So that's, but that's a small step. I think, I mean, if you look at it today, it costs about $5 a year to provide high quality contraceptive pills for a woman for a year. That's a $5 billion a year investment, and then you add another $5 billion for distribution and stuff. You could have that system working. So the tragedy is if you take, say, a country like India, on the books they have it. They say, look, we are doing it, you don't have to come in and mess with our culture, we will do it. But the problem is, they have the supply there in January, but it's not there February, March, April, May. You can't have that kind of a system and say, okay, you screw in January, but you don't do it in March, April, May. So that's where I think a global system would be phenomenal, because you could just say, fine, something like WHO says, we'll provide you, yes, you want to distribute, because I mean, the funny thing about working with HIV was, you said, there could be no other use for things like pills and condoms. So if you distributed them, how could anybody abuse them? Until, of course, I travel around India and I discover there's a phenomenal use for condoms, which is in the silk weaving industry, all the saris that Indian women wear. These are water-soluble lubricants. And so the weavers were using the condoms as for lubricating the shuttles and the thing. So this was a wonderful use of, but so far I have not come across a similar use for birth control pills. So if we could just, so what you want to do is remove the corruption, remove the lack of supply, and today we can do it for a reasonable amount of money. And we don't have to do it intrusively. We just said, look, we don't care. Here is it free. As a country, you can do it. So even today, countries like Egypt and many parts of the Middle East, we would never be able to go in and implement something. But there are organizations on ground which would be absolutely delighted to have this supply, and then they can do the promotion. The other thing I just want to point out, two of the most amazing examples of decrease in population rates have been in Muslim countries, and that's Iran and Bangladesh. Iran has had a phenomenal revolution in its reproductive health. It was in 86, the mullahs got concerned that their population was rising very fast, and they implemented a two-hour education program before a couple got married, and they provided them with reproductive health. Their woman fertility rate went down from little over 6 in 1986 to it's under 3 today. That's one of the most phenomenal transitions which has taken place, and in a country which we demonize every day. And so when people ask me about Iran, I say, look, here is a country, yes, they have a screwed up system, but in 20 years, no mother will be willing to lose a child when you only have two kids to deal with. So there's a phenomenal change which can, in variety of ways. And so I think, population is got to be an enormously important issue. And the statement I've made is, as physicists, we should understand that and put it on the agenda along with technological solutions. Because too often, in our own self-serving ways, we are stuck with technological solutions, and we don't understand that it's got to be a holistic thing. Sorry, Walter. Yes, absolutely. It is. The US data is there. Yeah, fully, right. I hope so. So can you help?
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Global Energy Observatory. Of course, you yourself understand perfectly that it is energy / climate
or environment. Yes.
Let me say climate.
Fine.
And you had it somewhere in the text. I was very impressed. I was at a meeting. Half Chinese, half non-Chinese in Beijing about 2 years ago, and I had been to meetings earlier. Always energy, 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 right? That was the growth period, the beginning of the early stage of the growth period in China. That was the first time they called this meeting energy climate.
Right.
And I was thrilled by that because those things are so
interlinked.
Interacting.
Right.
That Third, one remark. I want to come back to nuclear. We do have in a beginning with the two atomic bombs dropped by the United States on Japan, the only atomic bombs
ever detonated
in anger.
Right.
Anywhere. We now have in the last 10 years, right, we have the development of atomic weapons by, well, what did President Bush call it? The axis of evil, I think. Iran, North Korea, also India and Pakistan, and this is, you know India much better than I, but I was shocked when I traveled there some few years ago to see how universal support for nuclear energy is. And when I kind of pressed and I talked to some of the key people, like the director of the Indian Nuclear Energy Commission, then it became clear to me that this is, of course, a very important practical matter, but more important, prestige.
Yes.
I have generally spoken about nuclear energy as something that may well have to be developed further, but it should be a last resort, because proliferation is a huge danger.
Right.
A huge danger. And the time I've looked at those few countries that now have nuclear weapons, the time from a good nuclear energy, civilian energy infrastructure to nuclear weapons is about 5 to 7 years. It's very fast.
Right.
And it has happened in every case.
Well, not every case. There are 30 countries with nuclear power, but only about 8 nuclear weapons.
Yes.
They are virtual nuclear states.
Okay. I agree with you that the main problem is by not acting on this energy climate problem, as far as the United States is concerned, for a minimum of 8 years that we can
debate that even.
That's been a terrible loss that will be very, very hard to catch up on. So it is the fact that we'll come to this crunch when oil when it starts disappearing, in other words, after the peak, it goes very fast.
Right.
About 10 years, half of it.
Well, it's about, North Seas, it's about a 4.6% decline a year.
Yeah.
So it's very fast.
People have different numbers, but it's very fast, there's no question. And then you wait until the peak, let's say. I think it will be catastrophic. I don't think it can be done. So that's the urgency of action is one of the key features. Okay, I'll make one more remark. I was listening to the latest Obama speech, and he said, energy comes first.
Thank you. So, I mean, the issue with nuclear, which is what you're saying is absolutely correct. But I think when I say that we need nuclear for base power, I'm already saying it as a last resort. Because I do not see anything today over the next 30 years which is large enough that can be deployed and that can provide us with this respite on the energy climate issue. The second is that...
Can I comment on that?
Sure.
I did powered entirely by solar and wind energy.
Sure, that will happen, but not in the next 30 years. Pardon? Not in the next 30 years.
It can happen in the next 30 years.
So there are a variety of issues, and I'm going to mix both practical. I'll mix both practical and economic and technology. So today, in terms of photovoltaic, we are off by a factor of about 6 or 7 from where it's competitive with coal or something. Most countries are barely have resources to put in coal-fired power plants, leave aside solar. The second is the intermittency problem. We don't have a solution at an industrial scale for an intermittent source of energy. So that's another huge challenge. Third is, look at solar. Today, the entire global production of photovoltaic cells is 0.5 gigawatt a year. How are you going to, you have to ramp up. I told you, China is putting 50 gigawatts. That's a factor of 100 over the entire global photovoltaic. So, So you're right. So Los Alamos historically addressed a security issue, which energy is, 60 years ago, and came up with a paradigm, which was nuclear weapons. Why can't it be repeated? I'd just like to tell you, with the whole structure of Washington and stuff, national labs are basically being killed. Yeah. We don't know what the new administration will do, but the morale, the ability to do science, the ability to fund for funding, is just being decimated. I have hope. I mean, I canvassed, I voted for it, but I'm just saying that until that happens, see, again, it's time scales. Everything will take time. So suppose by the time Obama gets his act together and can start putting in money and takes care, it's 5 years. And 5 years, then it will take another 5 years or 10 years to recuperate or stuff. So today, many people have said, look, why can't we have the analog of man on the moon? Actually, that's a much more apt analogy than the Manhattan Project. And so if you look at the words of Obama, which, as Walter said, the last thing he heard, he says energy first, but he has not yet articulated the thing that we will get to the moon by the end of the decade. I mean, that was a historic statement. So I've tried many times, say, look, let's say we wanted 300 gigawatts of new nuclear power by 2030. What is it that we need to do? So a statement like that, which has a very clear statement that come what may, we will have a target of such and such a deliverable by such and such a date. Until that is formulated, it's not going to happen. Second, even in academia, I mean, everybody's fighting tooth and nails about what the solution is. So somebody is saying coal is bad, and the next person comes along and says, no, I can do cheap, clean coal. Somebody will say nuclear is bad. Somebody will say, look, I can solve everything with solar. So when you have such a divisive intellectual environment, there are no clear answers. So things are happening piecemeal, and that's a disaster in terms of some of these issues.
I know there's still a lot of questions, but I'd like to grab to be able to say, I've got to grab to some people who are using the
So I think, I mean,